Back on Downtown, our next guest, a pioneering sports writer and sportscaster who began working for the Boston Globe in the late 1970s, took her talents to CBS, and she is still there today. She is a Hall of Famer and one of our favorite people to talk with on the program, and she'll be part of a great gathering of the Boston Globe team from the 1980s coming up on April 14th in Reading, Massachusetts. We're happy to be joined by our friend Leslie Visser. First of all, let's talk about this wonderful event, Leslie, that's coming up on the 14th, the gathering from the Boston Bullpen Project of the Dream Team, that Boston Globe sports congregation of incredibly talented folks.
Oh, Rich, first of all, it's so great to talk to you. I know we talked baseball and hockey, and this is really wonderful. A guy put together, Mike Connolly, put together a group of us from the Globe. And, you know, whenever people say to me, oh, didn't you used to be a writer? I say, no, a writer is all I am, and that is the best that I will be, because I got to write when the Boston Globe had all, you know, they were all, we're all Halls of Famers, I guess, is that how you say it? But, you know, it was like Peter Gammons was the best on baseball. Bob Ryan, the best on basketball. Lee Montville, one of the greatest coaches. I used to cover Wimbledon with Bud Collins. Of course, the NFL with Will McDonough. So, actually, when CBS came to hire me, I said, why would I leave the Globe?
And all of this possible because of a Carnegie Foundation offer in, summer of 74, when you had an eight-week internship, essentially, with the Globe?
I did. Oh, thanks for asking. I wanted to be a sports writer from the time I was 10 years old. The job did not exist for women. And I told my mom, she said I was 10, we were living in Cincinnati, and she said, what do you think you want to be? She was a teacher. And I said, oh, I want to be a sports writer. And she didn't say, you know, you have to be so great with your kids, because she didn't say, oh, girls can't do that, you won't be able to do that. She said, that's great. Sometimes you have to cross when it says don't walk. So it was really profound for me. And, yeah, in my junior year at Boston College, I applied for a Carnegie Foundation grant that it was open to 20 women in America who wanted to go into jobs that were 95% male, which sports writing was 100% male. So I won one of them, and I got to go to the Globe on the foundation grant.
And then you ended up as a beat writer for the Patriots starting in 1975. And it was, is it safe to say that was a lonely place for a woman to be in those days?
You know, I look back on it, maybe you were like this too, Rich, or some of your listeners. I had to have been protected by my innocence, because it was nuts. I mean, they didn't have a ladies' room in the press box, so I'd have to wait till I was the first woman to cover the NFL as a beat. And I'd have to wait, you know, Patriots first and 10 on the 20, and I'd think, okay, can I get down the elevator across to the public restroom and run back up like Usain Bolt? And, you know, the Patriots were not the gold standard that we've come to know. They usually punted after three downs. But, you know, I used to go around the world. This is a true story. And I'd say, you know, like at Wimbledon, hi, I'm Leslie Visser from the Boston Globe. I work with Bud Collins. And, you know, the heavens would open. And on football, same thing. I work with Will McDonough. I work with Peter Gammons. I work with Bob. So it's really meant a lot. Dan Shaughnessy and I started the same summer. We covered high school football.
And I think it was Will McDonough who gave you the great advice, laugh now, cry later.
Oh, he really saved me. Okay, here's an embarrassing story. let's see. all right, so the Patriots were going down to play, I think it was Miami. You know, they were great, Miami, those 1970 Miami teams. And I was really nervous, and I asked Chuck Fairbanks, who was going to start at left tackle. They had two guys, Bob McKay and Tom Neville, and I think both were kind of injured. And Chuck Fairbanks said, neither one can play the position. So I went screaming back to the Globe. We didn't have computers or anything then. I drove 1,000 miles an hour. This is the scoop of the century. The coach says no one can protect Steve Grogan. So I go back there. We write it. It's in the paper the next day. My phone started ringing at, like, I don't know, 5:30 in the morning, and I can't use this language on the radio. But essentially, Chuck Fairbanks was saying, what is wrong with you? Are you out of your effing mind? I said, either one could play the position. I know you can feel it, can't you?
I can. Oh, God. Oh, yes.
One little letter. So I was crying. I called Will McDonough. I said, what am I going to do? And Willie said, you get your fanny down to practice right now, and you wait till everybody shows up, and you apologize. And I did.
Well, you were so lucky, too, to not only be working with so many talented people, but so many people who were there to support you along the way and help you out in so many different ways, too. I went back and revisited your wonderful memoir, by the way. Sometimes you have to cross when it says don't walk. And it was Peter Gammons who scored an extra ticket for you to get into the press box to see maybe the greatest baseball game of all time, Game 6 of the 75 World Series.
You know, it was unbelievable. Yes, Peter went to Tony Kubek. They were doing, actually, my former husband, Dick Stockton, as many people know, he called Carlton Fisk's home run, and that was the night I met him. And, yeah, Peter got me a credential. I don't know how. It would be so impossible now. And I just sat in the press box. I kept quiet. Someone had introduced me to Dick before the game, but, you know, it was a huge game for everybody. And, you know, I've told this before, how before Dwight Evans had that monster in the eighth inning, I think it was Ray Fitzgerald's lead had been, because you're typing them, you know, on the typewriter to give for them to fax it over to the Globe. And his lead was, you could feel it slipping away. And then, of course, after Dewey did his thing, he ripped it out, Ray ripped it out of the typewriter, and I, like, crawled around the floor, you know, like I was finding the first Gutenberg press in the Bible or something. And I, you know, I kept it forever. It was, yeah, really, really powerful to grow up. I think being from Boston, I always tell people, or New England, we care about three things. We care about sports and politics and talking about sports and politics. So I think you're lucky too. We're really lucky to have New England connections.
And a couple of guys who made it possible for you to finally get in a locker room, but perhaps not what people would expect. It was tennis, right? Team tennis, the Boston Lobsters, and that was made possible through Bob Kraft, and also I'm sure Bud Collins helped out, and then George Blaney, who was the longtime coach at Holy Cross.
Yes, yes. I mean, I have to say, I owe so much of my career to Bob Kraft, because actually to Myra also, because the Boston Globe assigned me. You know, I was very young. It was like 76 or something. I was right out of Boston College. And one of my beats were the Lobsters, and which were named by Bud, right, the Lobsters. And so there were no provisions anywhere in America for equal access. And Myra said to Bob Kraft, let her in. Who cares? You know, she's qualified. She's going to cover it. And it was wild because Jan Tyriak was the coach, and he would smoke in the locker room, and it was really nuts. And then, yes, George Blaney, I was the beat writer for Boston College basketball, and so, of course, they'd play Holy Cross. And George Blaney, yeah, he allowed me in, and then, of course, he went on to be great coach himself, great assistant at Connecticut, which, you know, here comes the Final Four. I always say Jim Calhoun built a dynasty out of the desert.
We're talking with Leslie Visser here on Downtown. That incredible staff of the Globe back in, well, really from the 70s through the mid-80s were so good. But what about management? What role did that play? Did they play in making sure that these people were able to do their work?
Oh, yeah. The Globe was really, really strong. I mean, Willie, he called Billy Sullivan, as you know, then the owner of the Patriots. And Willie said, we're going to have a woman on the beat, and that's that. And he hung up. And next thing you know, I'm covering the Patriots. But, you know, they had no provisions for equality. At least my first 5 years in the league, I was doing all the interviews out in the parking lot. Didn't matter if it rained, snowed, whatever. So that's why, I'm so encouraged now. There are so many women covering the NFL, covering all sports.
So, yeah, how has sports journalism evolved in these years, and we're headed in the right direction? We're not there yet. We're not where we would all like to be.
Well, if you ask a woman, you know, we it can't happen fast enough or more enough for us. But I look now and you see women, you see a woman on almost every broadcast, be it, it could be play-by-play, it could be a reporter. There are women writers in the press box. There are all kinds of digital women. We now are starting to see women. My friend Lisa Leslie coaches a men's team in the Big Three. So I sort of think, and at CBS, we have great people. Tracy Wolfson's fantastic. We have Lisa Byington and Beth Moen doing play-by-play. So I'm just really proud of something that started, you know, when they didn't even have ladies' rooms, and now we're all over the place.
So do you think for years, especially in terms of something like play-by-play, was that hesitance on the part of ownership, of media outlets, management, or was it the fans that maybe in some cases still can't quite handle having a woman do the play-by-play of a game?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of everything that you just said, Rich, because men didn't like to hear a woman's voice. Of course, now the number one brand, sport brand in the world from the United States are the Yankees, and Susan Waldman, who, of course, is from Boston, she's been on there for 20 years. So people did get used to it. I think also management resisted, you know, sort of the old chromosomal thing, like, well, how can she recognize a safety blitz? But heck, I did Monday Night Football. I was the first woman on Monday Night Football, and I did it with the greatest, Al Michaels, and he never played a down of football. So I used to say, you know, it's not genetic. It's, do you have the passion? Do you have the knowledge? Can you recognize it? And I think now women, they're also, I think we were all a little nervous, you know, in the beginning to say, I can do this, but it's just been shown so many times that women can. We had, after me, the great Jackie McMullen at the Boston Globe. So there have been great women at the Herald, and I don't know, you see them everywhere, and I love it. Like the other night when Caitlin Clark played Angel Reese, there were seven women, and we were all on a text about every single play. You might know Andrea Joyce, NBC, and Mary Carrillo. So now there's like a whole posse of us, and we talk all the time.
Your path, I think, was unique in that you had that writing background. As you said, you will always be a writer. What kind of advantage does that give someone when they go into broadcasting, having that writing background?
It's been enormous. It's what sustained me. I mean, I'm 70 years old now, and I still have a network contract. You know, people come and go all the time. And I think it's because your vocabulary is so much greater. Like, when people just use the word awesome, I speak at a lot of colleges, they use the word awesome. I say, what does that mean? Was it exciting? Was it large in size? Was it the first? Was it, how was it singular? But because that word doesn't really mean anything. So I think the more you read, the more analogies you have. And, you know, the Globe people, God forbid, you never use the cliche. You know, you tried to say something in an original way. And I think that's why the Globe got voted the number one sports section for like 10 straight years.
I work with young people teaching high school, and I say to them all the time, I don't care what line of work it is you're going into. The more you read, the more you know, the better you'll be in whatever those future endeavors are.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, most of the great screenwriters also have, they're well-read, they write things, they, and everything, because communication is so important, that I do think that when I was married to Dick, he used to laugh that both of us always had a bullpen of books. Like, right over there, okay, I'll get to that one. But I try to read anything, even things that are hard for me. You know, Japanese architecture, I don't really know much about it, but someday an analogy, it may be important.
But isn't that part of being good at what you do? The fact that you, and I say this to Bob Ryan all the time when he comes on the show, one of the reasons Bob is still so great is that he's never lost his curiosity.
Correct. Matter of fact, I'll tell you Bob's story in a second. Eleanor Roosevelt, who said the greatest thing a child can have is curiosity, because it'll sustain you your whole life. So the other day, so I'm on a text with those guys too. So it's like Lee and Dan and Ryan. You know, we're all the same people for like 50 years. And I was saying, about Connecticut, you know, getting to the Final Four. They've been going for their, sixth title. They're tied with Duke for five. And I said, holy West Balmasupnia. Remember him? And Bob goes on, which only Bob can do, saying, yes, the first time I saw him, he scored 28 and had six rebounds. And you know that's exactly right.
Well, of course.
And then he went into Toby Kimball, and it was like the schools, well, which Maine was, the Yankee Conference.
Right.
So, yeah, I think I just was so blessed to have 10 years at the Globe.
Bud Collins was such a unique talent. Can you share a story or two about working with him and being friends with Bud?
Yeah, I was privileged. I was one of the four people his family asked to speak at his memorial, which was so big they had to hold it at Trinity Church, you know, across from the public library in Boston. He touched everyone. No one was too big or too small. And at Wimbledon, the first Wimbledons I covered with him, we had to send our copy by Western Union. And so Bud, I remember, like, we'd be sitting there, and all kinds of people would be on all kinds of deadlines around the world, and Bud would be typing, and someone would walk up to him and say, Bud, who was the last Romanian female in the quarterfinals? And Bud would just look up while he was typing, you know, and say, Virginia Rozic, 1978, you know, or whatever. And it was like he took a ticket at the bakery, you know. Everybody wanted Bud's time, and he had time for everybody. And then he would have a restaurant called Santa Croce, which is on Cheney Walk in London, and anybody could come to dinner because it stays so light, so late in London. Wimbledon would go, you know, till 10 o'clock at night, and then we'd all go to Santa Croce, and Bud always had a table for 12. Sometimes it was six people, usually on July 4th. They didn't used to play on the off Sunday at Wimbledon, and we were all the expats on July 4th, and so that would be about 18 people, you know, Billie Jean and Pam Shriver, anybody who was American, and Bud would organize it. He was just, oh God, we miss him every day.
I wanted to ask you about the coverage of women, and you mentioned the wonderful basketball game the other night between Iowa and LSU. Do you find that there are still elements of the sports broadcasting world or sports journalism in general, but particularly sports radio, where they treat women differently, and I think of an Angel Reese or a Caitlin Clark, and behavior that would be seen as a positive if it were a male athlete is viewed very differently when it's a female athlete.
I don't think it's by a majority. I think it's by a few, which is really the difference. I remember, you know, if I asked a strange question or something, I would have been immediately condemned. But in the last, I would say, 5 years now, you see teams and players defending a woman if she's not treated properly, which is just a massive turnaround. But I think most people looked at it like those are two very competitive women, and it's between the lines, and they're very different, you know, different. They come from different backgrounds. But I think most people just saw the greatness of their game. And honestly, I think that Caitlin Clark, she must have Havlicek's pulse, don't you think?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
She doesn't show any pressure or nervousness, shoots from the logo. You know, she's not Steph Curry. People are trying to say she isn't Steph Curry, but she is so farther. When I went to high school, which was in Western Mass, out by the Berkshires, I was one of the rovers. There were six girls on the team, and only two of us could cross half court. I'm not talking about the 1800s here, but it was like they thought we'd get too winded. So, I mean, it's really just been astonishing, and really the result of Title IX that created everything we're seeing today.
Well, the landscape has changed certainly from the 1970s. Newspapers have their struggles, and I know, you know, even around here we've got a couple network affiliates that don't really have local sportscasters on the air anymore. Is it more difficult for newcomers to get into the business today, or does the internet and podcasting and all of that create these new opportunities that they're different but still provide those options for people?
Yeah, there, anybody can call himself a journalist now, which doesn't make you a journalist, but people, you know, they say it or they feel like they can, but there are a lot more opportunities. They don't pay very well, and, you know, I so lament the demise of newspapers. The Globe was a little late in adjusting to the digital side, but now they're you know, got that going. But, you know, I go around the country still all the time doing sports, and so many papers have gone out of business, and they'll just take the Associated Press, or they don't cover things. I mean, I felt like I was really in a golden age where the Globe sent people to do everything, really. I mean, I got, and even at CBS now, you know, now we have, everyone has a streaming side, and some of those are doing well, some are struggling, but there isn't any more where you just know that something, you can find it in one place, unless they're big events, which is why the networks, we pay $2 billion a year to have the NFL, because you can't get that anywhere else. You can only get the Super Bowl on the network that's carrying it.
The Boston Bullpen Project presents the Dream Team, the 1980s Boston Globe sports staff. That's April 14th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Jordan's Furniture IMAX Theater in Reading, Mass. It's going to be a wonderful evening. Leslie, it is always a treat for us to get to talk with you. Thanks for making time for us as always, and we wish you much continued success and good health.
Oh, Rich, there's a reason everybody loves talking to you, and if you're not doing anything, you have to come.
That sounds fantastic. I hope I can make it there. And by the way, if you haven't already, read Leslie's wonderful memoir, Sometimes You Have to Cross When It Says Don't Walk. Leslie Visser, thank you so much.
Bye, Rich. Thank you.
The great Leslie Visser with us here on Downtown. What a fantastic event that's going to be coming up on the 14th down in Reading.